Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Texas Republican Tom DeLay is resigning. The former House Majority Leader announced he'll give up his seat and not seek re-election. We'll speak with Texas Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee about DeLay, about her immigration bill, and about fellow Congressmember Cynthia McKinney. And a jury has ruled Zacharias Moussaoui eligible for the death penalty. We'll talk to FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley, and we'll look at the latest on the growing controversy over a rape scandal at Duke University. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Republican Congressmember Tom DeLay has announced he's resigning and giving up his House seat within the next few months. The former House Majority Leader has been one of the most powerful and controversial Republicans on Capitol Hill. DeLay announced his resignation just days after a former top aide, Tony Rudy, pleaded guilty in connection with a lobbying scandal involving Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Last November, DeLay's former press secretary, Michael Scanlon, also pled guilty to related charges. DeLay was up for his re-election, but polls showed he would likely lose. Last year, DeLay gave up his position as House Majority Leader after being indicted on criminal charges of conspiracy to violate Texas election laws. Federal investigators have also probed DeLay's personal dealings with Abramoff. DeLay's wife worked for the lobbying firm Alexander Strategy Group, which had close ties to the Republican lobbyist. In Iraq, the deaths of 9 U.S. troops were announced Monday, making it the deadliest day of the year for the United States. 13 U.S. troops have already died this month, nearly half the number who died in all of March. In other news from Iraq, new statistics show nearly 8 times as many Iraqis died in March in execution-style killings than in suicide and roadside bombings. This has prompted many Iraqis not previously involved in fighting to begin carrying weapons for protection. The Financial Times is reporting middle-class Sunni neighborhoods are now forming their own militias to counter the Shia militias and death squads. In news on the reconstruction of Iraq, The Washington Post reports the U.S. is far from reaching its goal of building 142 primary health clinics. The U.S. government gave the private company Parsons $200 million to complete the project, but so far, only 20 clinics have been built. Iraq's medical system has been devastated from the war and a decade of U.S.-imposed sanctions. Also in Iraq, new criminal charges have been brought against Saddam Hussein. The Iraqi tribunal is charging him with genocide and crimes against humanity in the 1980s crackdown against the Kurds, including the gassing of thousands of civilians in the village of Halabja. Hussein is already on trial for the killing of Shiites in a town north of Baghdad. The Supreme Court has voted not to take a case that would have determined whether the president has the power to indefinitely jail U.S. citizens without ever pressing charges. By a 6-3 ruling, the court decided not to hear an appeal filed by Jose Padilla. He's the U.S. citizen who was held without charge on a Navy brig for 3.5 years. He was accused of plotting to set off a dirty bomb. The majority of the justices on the court said Padilla's claim was merely hypothetical because he's no longer being held as an enemy combatant. In Virginia, a federal jury ruled Zacharias Moussaoui is eligible for the death penalty in connection with his role in the 9/11 attacks. Moussaoui was arrested in Minnesota in August 2001, but did not tell law enforcement about an imminent plan to attack the World Trade Center and Pentagon with hijacked planes. The jury determined that by lying to the FBI after his arrest, Moussaoui was directly responsible for at least one death in the 9/11 attacks. In Sierra Leone, former Liberian President Charles Taylor has pleaded not guilty to war crimes. He faces 11 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity in connection with his backing of the Sierra Leone rebels during the 1990s, when more than 50,000 people died in fighting. Charges include mutilation, sexual slavery, and sending children into combat. Taylor appeared in front of the War Crimes Tribunal for the first time on Monday.
I did not and could not have committed these acts against the sister republic of Sierra Leone. I think that this is an attempt to continue to divide and rule the people of Liberia and Sierra Leone, and so most definitely, I'm not guilty.
Taylor was indicted 3 years ago, but had been living in exile in Nigeria up until last week. He's the first former African president to be brought to trial to face charges of crimes against humanity and war crimes. Human rights officials have expressed hope that other African leaders, such as Chad's former dictator, Hissène Habré, will also be tried for war crimes. In other news from Africa, Sudan is blocking the top humanitarian official at the United Nations from visiting the Darfur region. The official, Jan Egeland, accused Sudan of trying to hide the ethnic cleansing that's occurring in the area. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times is reporting that disgraced Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff once proposed to sell his services to the Sudanese government to help improve its reputation in the United States. Sudan's ambassador to the United States revealed Abramoff offered to lobby on Sudan's behalf in Washington, but the multi-million-dollar deal never went forward. Last week, Abramoff was sentenced to nearly 6 years in jail. In other news from Africa, the government of Niger is barring the BBC from reporting on the country's increasing hunger crisis. The BBC recently revealed that Niger is facing severe food shortages and that 1,000 children were recently admitted within a single week to a feeding program for the malnourished. Officials said international and local media would not be allowed to do stories about the food situation as they did not want that subject touched. In business news, ExxonMobil is now atop the Fortune 500 list of nations' largest publicly traded companies. Last year, Exxon pulled in $340 billion in revenue and a record $36 billion in profits. Walmart came in second on the Fortune 500 list. In France, nationwide protests are occurring again today to protest a new law that'll make it easier for companies to fire young workers. Transport strikes have been reported in 32 French towns and cities. And in Haiti, the group Reporters Without Borders is urging the Haitian government to reopen investigation into the killing of the pioneering radio journalist Jean Dominique. He was gunned down in the courtyard of Radio Haiti Inter on April 3, 2000. Dominique was profiled in Jonathan Demme's documentary, The Agronomist, 2 years ago. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to the issue of immigration. On Capitol Hill, heated debate is continuing over a bill passed by the Senate Judiciary Committee last week that would allow the 11 million undocumented immigrants living in this country a chance to work here legally and eventually become U.S. citizens, a process that would take 11 years and include paying fines and back taxes. But support for the legislation in the Senate is uncertain, and there's already talk of a possible filibuster by Republican senators opposed to what they call amnesty for illegal immigrants. On Monday night, a group of Republican senators reached for a compromise that hoped would bolster votes for the bill. The talks were led by Republican Chuck Hagel of Nebraska and Mel Martinez of Florida. Under the compromise proposal, undocumented workers who could produce pay stubs, billing records, or other proof showing they've lived and worked in the United States for 5 years would qualify for a work visa and an opportunity to apply for citizenship. They could stay in the country as they apply for a green card. Those not meeting the requirements would have to return to their native countries. Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter said after leaving the meeting, quote, people who have roots who ought to be treated differently. Any bill that passes the Senate would have to be reconciled with a House bill passed last year that has been described as the most repressive immigration bill in 70 years. H.R. 4437 would, among other things, turn every undocumented immigrant into a felon and make it a crime to offer help to undocumented immigrants. The bill sparked widespread demonstrations and student walkouts of historic proportions across the country. We're going to turn to Democratic Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, who's called the immigration issue the civil rights issue of our time. She joins us in the studio in Houston. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Jackson Lee.
My pleasure.
But before we go
to be with you this morning.
Before we go to the issue of immigration, I just wanted to get your comment on this latest breaking news, and that is the issue of Tom DeLay. Congressmember Tom DeLay, the former House Majority Leader, has announced he's resigning and giving up his House seat within the next few months. He's been, of course, one of the most powerful and controversial Republicans on Capitol Hill. Your response?
Well, anytime there is a personal tragedy where someone has to give up something I believe they love and enjoy, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for him, his family, and the state of Texas. However, he remains political to the end. And frankly, I hope that we will have an opportunity now to elect an individual who will be uniting in the state of Texas, who will work together with members of Congress for the betterment of this state and its people, as opposed to dividing us and attempting to conquer on the basis of divisive issues such as redistricting and other issues that distract away from us serving the people of this state.
What do you think it will mean for the Congress? Of course, he's been forced out of the most powerful position in the House. Now he's leaving permanently, or he's leaving now, giving up his seat.
Well, I don't think it has as great an impact as one might think. I hope that the people of the 22nd District will have a vigorous campaign. Nick Lamson is a Democratic nominee, an outstanding former member of Congress who cares about the district and I believe will make an excellent candidate. As relates to the United States Congress, one of the issues that Americans have been talking about for a number of years now, since I've been in, is the divide in our Congress, the bitterness in our Congress. And it keeps us from finding unity around issues that helps to move America forward. Obviously, Democrats want to take back this Congress so that we can bring some civility back. And I'm hoping that maybe amongst Democrats and Republicans, we'll finally realize that every issue should not be partisan, every issue should not be divisive, that frankly we have issues that address the quality of life for all Americans, and we need to address those questions, whether it's the Iraq War, whether it's the question of immigration, whether it's the question of full funding of education. Americans, I think, are tired of divisiveness, and they frankly want us to move forward. The question will be, for any of us who take the majority in 06, of how we can be the kind of uniting factor that allows real issues to be discussed and the real issues of the American public who are crying out for change to be at our highest priority. I think with Tom DeLay's departure, maybe we'll have an opportunity to do that.
And do you see the new majority leader, John Boehner, as taking any kind of a different path than DeLay?
Well, I think that the Republican conference and members of Congress, certainly individually, we've had opportunities to work together. But frankly, I think the leadership has to ask themselves the question after going on the same pathway that really was set by the majority leader, the former majority leader, or whether or not they are willing to collaborate. Leader Pelosi has offered a number of hands of, if you will, goodwill to the Republicans. And frankly, I don't know if they've been accepted. The whole issue of corruption is one that the Republicans have to deal with mostly. And they have to deal with it in a way that confronts the color of corruption that has existed amongst them. The issues dealing with the Iraq War are not allowing us to have a full debate on that question as to how we can reconcile the tragedies that are going on in Iraq and bring our soldiers home with dignity and still allow the Iraqi people to govern. If they continue to restrict democratic amendments, democratic substitutes, amendments that we would ask to be debated in the Congress out of fairness, if we continue to have extended votes like we did in the Medicare, then I would question whether or not there is a change and whether or not we need a complete change, and that is to ensure that Leader Pelosi will be the Speaker and we begin to construct a even-handed process in the United States House. It can be done. I don't know if this present leadership is prepared to do so at this time.
Congressmember Jackson Lee, you've submitted an immigration bill to Congress that would allow for legal permanent residency for undocumented immigrants who've lived in the United States for how long?
If they've been living consistently in the United States between 5 and 6 years.
Can you talk about, just give us the layout of your bill and where it stands now?
To give you some framework, I want to at least mention the tone of the debate that is occurring now in the United States Senate and what occurred in the House. The great disappointment of this issue is that the members of Congress who were so opposed, outrageously opposed, to any fair consideration of documentation of the undocumented individuals in this country really sort of debated this as if they had no sense of humanity, no sense of family, and no sense of what this country was built on, and that is, of course, immigrants coming from all over the world during periods of our history and making this country great. In fact, many of us know that African Americans came to this country not as documented citizens and did not obtain citizenship until very, very late. So I'm disappointed at the level of debate. My bill attempted to craft this as a civil rights issue, and that is to give a sense of fairness to individuals who had been in this country and had worked and paid taxes and wanted to come from under the shadows. And it provided the earned access to legalization with English conversance, the idea of working, investment in the community, family, and community service and no felon record. We also provided for family unification. We provided for the DREAM Act so that children could go to school. We eliminated or provided penalties for the utilization of fraudulent documents, for the abuse of women, for the abusive workplace, which would take advantage of those who are undocumented. We insisted that employees provided a safe workplace and a workplace with dignity and equal rights. We also provided for the anti-smuggling provisions that would stop the coyotes from bringing individuals across the border and causing danger to their lives. We looked at this in a holistic viewpoint that, in fact, if you identify the undocumented individuals, they become investors in this society. They become part of the economic engine. They invest their dollars in banks. They don't send most of their money back overseas. They're allowed to have bank accounts in our country, which is a part of an economic engine. The disappointment in this debate that is now being politicized in the Senate is that we're being overtaken by minority voices within the Republican Party. Because if you explain to the American people, one, I'm prepared to protect your jobs, and by the way, I have a provision in my bill that takes the fees that immigrants would pay to become documented and utilize them for job creation amongst American workers and protection of American workers and job training. I try to bring two disparate groups together in the legislation that I've authored, Save America Comprehensive Immigration Bill, which has the support of many members of Congress. The disappointment was that in the debate, we didn't allow all members' bills to be fully debated. The McCain-Kennedy bill on the House side, which was a Colby, Gutierrez bill, my bill, and a number of others, never had an opportunity either to be debated and or to be voted on because of the singular, unilateral, exclusive approach that the Republicans took and the chairman of the Judiciary Committee took. None of us were allowed to submit our legislation.
Yesterday, Congressmember Jackson Lee, we were speaking with Professor Ron Walters, who is raising the issue of the concerns of African Americans that immigrants take jobs in this country. Your response?
You're absolutely right. Professor Walters is absolutely right. This is what is permeating throughout the nation, and that's why I've said that we have operated in this debate with the wrong facts. With the idea of creating divisiveness rather than finding a common ground that would educate Americans, no matter whether they're African Americans or whether they are white Americans or Asian Americans or others. Let me share with you what I think is really the framework of difficulty in the African American community. With our communities having the highest unemployment rate, with administrations or the administration and this Congress being very unconcerned about the plight of African-American males, the plight of poor quality schools, yes, I can sympathize and empathize with the African-American community about what they perceive to be a population group that takes jobs. But frankly, that is not the case. If you look at the large percentage of the undocumented who are working here, unfortunately, they are working in jobs that possibly are available to African-Americans and they have chosen not to take. Or as the normal progression of immigration occurs, each group comes in and the group preceding them moves up. The heavy hand of discrimination in this nation has kept many in the African-American community from achieving their dreams, from gaining jobs and gaining education opportunities. And of course, we have not responded to it. It appears then that any group that is working may be taking their job. But what we need to do to address this question is invest in job training, invest in the protection of American jobs, stop the outsourcing that is impacting Americans of all races, and begin to look at the 11 million undocumented as an economic engine that would churn the economy, helping to create more jobs.
Congressman,
I am sympathetic, and I think that's an important response.
Do you have the support of the Congressional Black Caucus on your bill?
I think we have the support of many members of the United States Congress, which include members of the Democratic Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus, and yes, the Black Caucus, and of course, and the Asian Pacific Congress. We have received support from across the Congress, and it would have been, the House that is, would have been an appropriate part of the debate if we had been allowed to have that debate, including the House version of the McCain-Kennedy bill, which was not allowed on the floor, neither was mine not allowed on the floor. I hope to participate as a member of the conference committee, which is a place where maybe reasoned minds could generate a debate. Unfortunately, I don't know if that will be the case, in as much as I understand the chairman of that conference may be the author of the House bill. I hope that we will have a conference that will be open, that will be inclusive, and will allow us to produce a product that is, if you will, deserving of the reputation that America has of respecting the rights of all human beings. And might I just say this, I talked to a young Hispanic male yesterday in a high school. It was one of the most emotionally charged meetings or conversations with a youngster, a person under the age of 18. We had just had a whole class talking about this question because, as you would know, many high school students around the country have been walking out, and they're still doing so, and we've been going to high schools to discuss this. He asked the question, does America want him anymore? Is he wanted? He felt so hurt and so disenfranchised, and he was not documented, but he wanted to join the United States military, and he'd always wanted to do it. It was his dream, along with a number of his classmates, but he asked me the question, and it was so difficult to answer, am I wanted? What is this debate about making me a felon? And I think America can do better, and I think we need to have a better debate and a better response to individuals who simply come here for an economic opportunity.
You have called this the civil rights issue of our time.
I believe it is, and that's one of the reasons why I truly believe that there is an opportunity for the African-American community to be great leaders in this movement. We understand discrimination. We understand isolation and separation. We also understand striving and fighting for just a chance, an economic chance or a chance of dignity. I believe this is a great opportunity for the civil rights organizations of both communities, Hispanics and African Americans, Muslims, and others who've been discriminated against to come together. That is why the NAACP and LULAC have worked together and are struggling to understand this issue of immigration. Because if you have a large body of individuals who you isolate and discriminate against, what is the question? It is civil rights. Many people believe these are illegal persons. They have broken the law, and this word of amnesty has become an ugly word. I don't even call it amnesty. I call it the right to earn the access to legalization.
Congressmember
Jackson, I call it the right to earn dignity, and I believe it is a civil rights question.
Congressmember Jackson Lee, I know you have to leave soon to catch a plane. This is also the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, and I wanted to ask you about this controversy that is brewing in Washington with the Capitol Police saying they were seeking a warrant to arrest your fellow Congressmember, Cynthia McKinney, for an altercation with a police officer last week. Congressmember McKinney spoke on CNN with Wolf Blitzer yesterday, and I wanted to get your response. This is Congressmember Cynthia McKinney.
There are only 14 African-American women members of Congress. So I don't understand what it is about my face that certain members of the Capitol Hill Police Department can't remember.
Well, here's what
your response, Congressmember Jackson Lee,
to what has happened to her. First of all, I think all of us, including Congresswoman McKinney, respects the Capitol Police and respects them for their responsibility and their job. But I believe that she is quite accurate in the fact that there are very few of us who happen to be African-American women, and there are very few of us who would be so, if you will, difficult to be remembered, if you will, or to be able to be noticed. And frankly, many of us get either confused or ask for our ID or treated in a manner that is not necessarily accepting. And in this incident, it was unfortunate. But it is the role of the Capitol Police, of whom we respect, to basically know the members of the United States Congress. And if you're rushing toward a vote, a House vote, and I think people should understand we have 15 minutes to cast a vote, no matter where you might be in the entire capital of Washington, D.C. You might be in meetings off the Hill. You still have 15 minutes to vote. It's very difficult then to be stopped while the clock is ticking for you to cast your vote. So I think this is a question, first of all, where it should be resolved away from the cameras. I certainly don't think an arrest warrant is appropriate. I hope that the arrest warrant is not issued so that there can be an issue on the Democratic side of the aisle while there is an issue now with Tom DeLay on the Republican side of the aisle. And I hope that this can be resolved, respecting the Capitol Police, respecting Congresswoman McKinney, who serves well in the United States Congress and serves her constituents. But most of all, I hope that we can reconcile this issue so that we can continue our work. I think it's an issue that clearly has the opportunity to be reconciled outside the legal process, and that any difficulty in identification can be solved in an administrative manner.
Has this ever happened to you where you are not recognized?
Oh, on several occasions. And, of course, you have to suffer the indignity and sometimes handle it in a way that you don't care to handle it because of the fact that you believe that you've served in the United States Congress and that you should be identifiable. So there is merit to the points that she is making, and there certainly may be some concerns about securing the Capitol, which we understand has taken a whole different tone after 9/11. But I think cooler heads can address this question in a way other than the criminal justice system of issuing an arrest warrant for a member of the United States Congress who was within her right to be in the building and within her right to be rushing toward the House floor to vote, as I understand the facts, and certainly should have had the courtesies of the Capitol Police, as we should extend courtesies. So why can't this be resolved where we learn who each other happens to be and we improve the picture book, if you will, and the training so that we all can be fully identified? There is no requirement, by the way, for any member to have an ID. We do have them, but we may have been rushing from somewhere and not carrying the ID, and there is no requirement for us to have a pen, which is our identifying pen, which I happen to be wearing at this time. But there is no requirement, as I understand it, for members to have that at this time.
Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Congressmember Jackson Lee, speaking to us from Houston, Texas. And for those who are not up on the controversy with Congressmember McKinney, she is charging she was treated with racial bias. She held a news conference on Friday to denounce the actions of a Capitol Hill police officer. She was flanked by entertainers Danny Glover and Harry Belafonte, surrounded by school children, black school children, holding signs that read, "Is Cynthia a target?" She and her lawyers said that the officer failed to recognize her, then touched her inappropriately, and that her treatment represented a pattern of police harassment of black people. We'll have more on this in a minute. Jazz saxophonist Jackie McLean. He died last week at the age of 74. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Congressmember Cynthia McKinney's run-in with the Capitol Police officer isn't the only recent case where an African-American lawmaker has accused government officials of racial profiling. In February, several members of the Georgia legislature were denied entry to the main area where Coretta Scott King's body was on public view. Congressmember McKinney addressed that incident in her interview with Wolf Blitzer on CNN on Monday.
But today we had black elected officials from the Georgia Legislative Black Caucus. At the time when Coretta Scott King's body lay in state at the Georgia State Capitol, the Georgia Legislative Black Caucus was not allowed into the building to form a part of the procession. Why? They can't even answer the question, except that the security at the Georgia Capitol did not recognize them as duly elected members able to carry out the mandate of the people who sent them to the legislature.
That was Congressmember Cynthia McKinney speaking on CNN's with CNN's Wolf Blitzer on Monday. Well, today is the 38th anniversary of the assassination of Coretta Scott King's husband, Dr. Martin Luther King. We're joined right now by one of the Georgia state legislators who was denied entry to see the body of Coretta Scott King at the Georgia Capitol. Abel Mabel Thomas is a Georgia state representative. She speaks to us from Atlanta. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, and peace and love.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the incident that Congressmember McKinney was referring to?
First, I want to just give honor to the King family for all the work that they've done and the impact they've had on the nation. And I know this is a trying time for them based upon the fact that this is the time that their father was assassinated. But what I would like to say is that we consider Mrs. King as family, the whole King family is like the first family of black America. And for us to have to not be allowed to go on what we call the second floor, which is where the rotunda is in the state capitol, and basically be told that we had to wait upstairs, which is on the third floor where our chamber is, we think it was just really, it was just unheard of that we would be treated that way. And basically what we did as legislators is we followed the protocol because it was a sacred ceremony, and we did not want to have the news coverage be about us, because we knew the news coverage was about the passing of a gentle and a strong warrior for our people. And so we know that not only just in Washington, D.C., but in Georgia and probably throughout this nation, those persons, black elected officials, have not been treated with the type of dignity that they have been given by our constituents when they vote for us. But we have sort of had to sort of bear it and just go along and get along, because we are trying to not be the news story. We're trying to impact our communities.
How unusual was your treatment, Representative Abel Mabel Thomas?
Well, I think it was highly unusual. I know that there have been other dignitaries that have passed, and when there was a procession, the legislators, all legislators, have been a part of that. For some reason, at this particular ceremony, which was a sacred ceremony to us as Black America, we were not allowed to enter the procession or be a part of it in a meaningful way. And so actually we were relegated to the what we call the third floor, and we had to look over the balcony to see the proceedings.
We're talking to Representative Abel Mabel Thomas in the Georgia State Legislature. I just was in Atlanta this weekend, and I went over to the King Center, saw the tomb of Coretta Scott King next to Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King, assassinated 38 years ago today. Your final thoughts, Representative Abel Mabel Thomas, on Dr. King today?
Well, one thing we know is that Dr. King's legacy was a one of love, and Ms. King's legacy was a one of love. And so in the midst of this, we just send love throughout the country and let it be known that we in Black America continue to suffer, but we also continue to stand.
Go.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Georgia State Representative Abel Mabel Thomas, speaking to us from Atlanta. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we move on to another issue, the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. On Monday, a jury ruled that Moussaoui is eligible for the death penalty in connection with his role in the 9/11 attacks. Moussaoui has already pleaded guilty to conspiring to hijack aircraft with al-Qaeda and other crimes. He's claimed he was supposed to have been part of the 9/11 attack and that he was training to fly a fifth hijacked plane into the White House on that day. He said he lied to the FBI after his arrest to allow the September 11th attacks to go forward. The trial will now move into its second phase, where the jurors will decide whether Moussaoui should be executed. The case against Moussaoui has brought embarrassment to prosecutors and government officials. Last month, the judge barred the testimony of several prosecution witnesses after it was revealed a government lawyer had violated court rules by improperly coaching the witnesses. And just days later, a former FBI supervisor revealed during testimony that he did not read a memo that had warned of possible hijackings before the 9/11 attacks. Many people who lost loved ones on 9/11 attended the trial. Abraham Scott, whose wife Janice Marie Scott died in the attack on the Pentagon, shared his thoughts after the verdict was read.
Even though I do believe that he deserved the death penalty, I also equally blame the government for not acting on certain indicators that could have prevented 9/11 from happening. I would also say that I love my wife truly, and I know that whatever happened to him will not bring her back, but I do believe that the death of Moussaoui will bring comfort to those family as well as individual across the world and this country that have been impacted adversely with the tragedy on September 11, 2001.
That was Abraham Scott. His wife, Janice Marie Scott, died in the attack on the Pentagon. We're joined now by Colleen Rowley. She's the former FBI special agent turned whistleblower who accused FBI officials of hampering the investigation of Zacharias Moussaoui and ignoring critical warnings before the 9/11 attack. She was chosen Time Woman of the Year. She is now running for Congress, and she speaks to us from Minnesota. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us, Colleen Rowley. Can you talk about what we know at this point of Zacharias Moussaoui and how you dealt with him in the past, what you understood?
Well, this case is just an absolute showcase for all of these major issues right now in the so-called war on terrorism. And I could probably talk for a couple of hours about many of the issues involved. I don't want to actually talk about the facts simply because this case is not over and it's going to a death penalty phase now where another jury is going to be hearing further evidence about the specific facts. But, you know, the big issue here is whether a suspected terrorist can be dealt with in our criminal courts. And if you buy the argument, as many administration officials have made now, that this actually might be the last case. I've actually heard that people saying this is the last time you're ever going to see a terrorist dealt with in our criminal courts. And, of course, if you don't deal with them in the criminal courts, then you're allowed to go around all criminal procedure and the Constitution. So, I like I said, this is a huge case in terms of many, many legal issues.
Can you talk about the testimony of your fellow FBI agent, Simmet? He said he sent, was it 90 emails, memos to those above?
Well, of course, my 12-page memo, this long time ago now, seems like ancient history, but my 12-page memo that was written in May of 2002 was written for this reason, that in order to fix the things that went wrong pre-9/11, you have to deal with the truth. And for 8 or 9 months, even after 9/11, many of the solutions, supposed solutions to what went wrong were really not on the mark. And that was because a lot of these facts were, you know, were being sugarcoated. And I said cover up was a little too strong, but certainly they were being glossed over. What you see in this case is the agents at the bottom of the chain did it right. And the people at the top, the administrators in their kind of ivory-covered palaces or whatever, didn't understand the situation. Most terrorists are thwarted really due to people, good agents and good investigative work, and oftentimes it's like a trooper who stops a terrorist. The Rassam case, the case of the Millennium Bomber, is actually a model of how it should be done. In that case, a customs inspector was able to stop a terrorist on their way down from Canada in 2000 to bomb the Los Angeles airport. And then, of course, the criminal justice system was good in that it handled this case fine and was able to get the cooperation, actually, of that terrorist and actually provided a lot of information that helped us combat future terrorists.
Colleen Relly, I want to ask you where you think terror suspects should be charged and get your response to the Supreme Court ruling not to take a case that would have determined whether the president has the power to indefinitely jail U.S. citizens without ever pressing charges, the Jose Padilla case, the court deciding not to hear his appeal, the U.S. citizen held without charge on a Navy brig for 3.5 years.
Well, it's important to understand that the court here did not really rule on the merits of this enemy combatant status. In fact, if anything, it seemed to criticize this kind of that this is outside our Constitution. All they did in this case was say that the case is no longer ripe for judicial to hear it. It's moot because he was transferred to criminal courts at this point, or to a military tribunal. I think that we do need I'm just really arguing the urgency of looking at these issues from the legal perspective right now, because so many people say, we can't use our Constitution to investigate terrorists, nor to deal with them after they're caught. We need to do things like rendition and enemy combatant status and even torture, for instance, which is certainly outside the Constitution. We need to use those tools because this is a new war. Everything's changed after 9/11. And our old system is no longer capable. And I think it's an absolutely huge issue, because what we're also going to see is, as time goes on, are more and more Americans, like Padilla, actually. Padilla, of course, was a homegrown American. And al-Qaeda terrorists are going to be using more and more people that blend in and fit in. And then we're going to get this blend between domestic certainly our domestic criminal justice system and what we would normally think of as the international terrorists and counterterrorism.
Colleen Relly, I want to thank you for being with us. Former FBI special agent accused FBI officials of hampering the investigation of Zacharias Moussaoui and ignoring warnings of possible hijackings. She was named Time Woman of the Year and is now running for Congress. We speak to her in Minneapolis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. We'll be right back. Roy Campbell, Malcolm, Martin, and Mandela. Today is the 38th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Liberian ex-president Charles Taylor made his first court appearance Monday since he was apprehended last week. A UN-backed tribunal will try Taylor for committing crimes against humanity in Sierra Leone. At Monday's hearing, Taylor was defiant.
I do not recognize the jurisdiction of this court. I did not and could not have committed these acts against the sister republic of Sierra Leone. I think that this is an attempt to continue to divide and rule the people of Liberia and Sierra Leone, and so most definitely I'm not guilty.
Charles Taylor was apprehended in Nigeria, where he'd been living in exile since 2003. He stepped down as Liberian president that year after a 14-year civil war that killed at least 400,000 people and displaced millions more. His case marks the first time a former African leader will be tried on African soil for crimes against humanity. We're joined now by Corinne Dufka. She is the senior researcher and the West Africa team leader for the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, speaking to us from Dakar, Senegal. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the significance of Charles Taylor being tried?
Well, it indeed is a very, very welcome development, because Mr. Taylor has been really at the epicenter, we can say, of a violent act and instability within several countries in West Africa, obviously Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and then most recently Cote d'Ivoire. He has, however, been indicted in the special court for Sierra Leone for acts that he allegedly committed there. These are very serious acts, including there's a helicopter going over. It's Independence Day here in Senegal. These are very serious acts, including the use and recruitment of child soldiers, rape, and other sexual violation of women, killing, and so on. He has not been indicted, obviously, for crimes committed in Liberia, although his indictment for crimes in Sierra Leone does not preclude him, of course, from being held accountable for crimes committed in Liberia as well.
Can you explain what he has done exactly, and what's the documentation, and then how this fits in, for example, with the attempt to try Hussein Habre of Chad?
Well, Taylor's been indicted. First, it was 17 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity, and that has been condensed down to 11. And he, interestingly, for those of your listeners and viewers who don't understand the connection, the West Africa region has been typified by leaders showing a willingness to undermine the presidencies and undermine the stability in its neighbors. And in 1989, Mr. Taylor launched a bid to unseat the Liberian president, Samuel Doe. And then in 1991, he was the key and primary backer of Sierra Leonean Revolutionary United Front, which is an atrocious rebel organization. So the account, he didn't, of course, wasn't directly involved in committing any of these. He didn't set foot in Sierra Leone very often during these acts, but he was the primary backer, funder, generated arms, and certainly derived a lot of economic benefit in terms of from the diamond sales and from the diamonds that he extracted, or that the Sierra Leonean rebels extracted and then gave to him. His indictment is very significant in that it represents really an effort to end this very vicious and deadly cycle of impunity that has undermined the lives, ruined the lives of millions of West Africans. So I think it's a very significant act. In terms of Hissan Habre, he, of course, has been indicted for crimes committed in Chad. The case has now gone to the African Union to decide what the next course of action should be. But we, of course, hope that the African Union decides that to support the extradition of Mr. Habre to Belgium, where he can be tried there, where he has been indicted.
And Hissein Habre, why Chadian victims want him tried?
Well, he's been indicted for having been involved in the torture and killing of several thousand Chadians during his regime there. And it would be extremely significant, I think, if the African Union were to take a position on this. The African Union's founding principles talk about the importance of the rule of law and impunity. And again, you know, Africa is plagued with these vicious cycles of impunity that and not holding its leaders responsible for these atrocities then emboldens them and commits this ever continuing vicious cycle, which I think the indictment of Mr. Taylor and certainly the other nine people who are currently being held and being tried will then begin to see an end and chip away at this vicious cycle of impunity.
Let me ask you about Sudan. It's blocking the top humanitarian official at the United Nations from visiting the Darfur region. The official is Jan Egeland, and he's accused Sudan of trying to hide the ethnic cleansing that's occurring in the area. Any response to that?
Yeah, I'm in charge of West Africa, so it would be, I think it would be useful also to talk with our Darfur researchers. But I think Sudan is another, it clearly is another example of a leader who is supporting, has been implicated in atrocious crimes there, and we believe that the International Criminal Court should be allowed to get into Sudan to conduct their investigations, to begin also to work on its indictment, perhaps against leaders, even the president of Sudan.
Finally, back on Charles Taylor, what do you see the timetable as being for this trial in Sierra Leone?
Well, I think Mr. Taylor's defense team, which hasn't even been appointed yet, needs a good maybe 5 or 6 months in order to prepare their defense, like any case. The special court is now looking at transferring Mr. Taylor to The Hague, where he will be detained there. Of course, the trial will still be conducted by the officials of the special court, but given concerns about Mr. Taylor's continued contact with his erstwhile commanders and rebels who supported him and fighters who supported him for many years, there are concerns that there could be security risks for Sierra Leone and indeed Liberia if he were to remain in Sierra Leone. So they're talking about actually transferring him up to The Hague. But anyway, we believe that we expect the trial to begin probably within 6 months or a little bit longer, because it takes time to actually, put together a defense. And he's looking to bring in lawyers from, I think, the UK and even the United States. So that's going to take some time to get together, as well as arguing all the motions and so on that his defense might put forth.
Corinne Dufka, I want to thank you very much for being with us, senior researcher and the West Africa team leader for the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, speaking to us from Dakar, Senegal. As we move now into our last segment, we're going to turn to the story of Duke University, a case that's making headlines on the issue of race and gender. A black female student from North Carolina Central University has accused three white members of Duke University's lacrosse team of rape. The alleged incident took place last month. The woman was hired as a dancer for a lacrosse team party held in a house rented from Duke University. There, she says she was beaten, raped, and choked by three white lacrosse team members who also called her racial epithets. The lacrosse team denies the allegations. Police have not filed charges, but are taking DNA tests of nearly all the team's members in an effort to identify the suspects. At least one witness says he heard lacrosse team members making racial slurs. Jason Bissey, who lives next door to where the party was held, said he heard one player yell at the woman, quote, "Thank your grandpa for my nice cotton shirt." The derogatory remarks have not been confined to the night of the incident. Last week, radio show host Rush Limbaugh called the woman a derogatory two-letter word often used to describe a prostitute. A number of students and community members have rallied to support the woman. Last Wednesday, activists distributed wanted flyers with photos of the lacrosse players as hundreds participated in the annual Take Back the Night March against rape. We're joined in the studio in Durham, North Carolina, by Lahoma Smith-Ramaki. She is assistant professor at North Carolina Central University. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you...
Thank you very much.
Can you update our listeners and viewers around the country about this case and the allegations of the student about the members of the lacrosse team?
Well, I will try. What we know is that a young woman who had been hired by the Duke lacrosse team to dance for them has alleged that she was brutally assaulted and victimized by the members of the Duke lacrosse team. As you said, the students, we are all students involved here. The young woman, a student at North Carolina Central University, and the Duke students all have maintained that their version of the events are the accurate one.
So the police have taken DNA of 46 of the 47 members of the lacrosse team. They did not take the DNA of the black member of the lacrosse team. She said that the people who raped her were white.
That is my understanding.
Can you talk about the response right now, both at Duke and where you are at North Carolina Central University?
I can tell you that the response on the Duke campus, the response in the Durham community, and the response on NCCU's campus has been tremendous. I think that people are concerned about issues of justice here. You know, if you look on the side of the young men who are alleged to have committed this horrendous crime, they are maintaining their innocence, and they have their supporters. Naturally, you know, we do live in a country where you are presumed innocent till proven guilty. On the other hand, however, you have the young woman who is alleging that she was a victim here, and that we are on the NCCU campus wanting that she would have the same consideration of being innocent, if you will. That is, that her views are considered, that she is held to be at least to have some consideration and support until we know exactly what happened from the police investigation. We are looking that neither the young men or the young women here are condemned until we have more facts.
Professor Amaki, the median income in Durham is about the same as the cost of 1 year. I think it's $41,000 for 1 year of going to Duke. Can you talk about the racial and class divide between the university and the town?
I think that the university has, for a long time, been struggling with this image of, you know, Duke University, an elite institution, certainly a world-class institution. I must say that I am a graduate of Duke University, and I'm a Durham resident. And so I'm well aware of the history of the university, but also of its efforts to try to deal with the ongoing tensions between the university and the community. On the other hand, there are some real issues here about how the university responded to the allegations. I think that, you know, class continues to be a concern, that if the young woman perhaps had been another race, or if perhaps she had not been working, that that perhaps the case would not have evolved the way it did. I think that, you know, Duke is a very prestigious institution, and, you know, pitted against a primarily blue-collar community, there are still many who question that if this had happened on the other side of town, whether the reaction would have been the same, and whether the judicial process now that we are seeing unfold, and the police investigation, if it would have been the same thing.
Professor Amaki, I want to thank you for being with us. That does it for our broadcast. DemocracyNow.org is our website. Special thanks to Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.